This is part of a series on the Eightfold Path. Does anyone not know the Eightfold Path? Okay. So we're on the wise effort part of it, which is it goes wise view, wise intention, wise livelihood, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And the first two, wise view and wise intention, are really just taking care of our mental responses to the world and really having our concepts. Our concepts can never be reality, but they can be aligned with reality, or at least pointing towards reality. But as the Zen saying goes, there can be a finger pointing at the moon, but the finger is never the moon. Our thoughts indicate reality without being. We're always thinking about something. We're symbolizing something. So the thoughts are never the thing. They're the map and not the territory. But wise view is really about having those thoughts be most clearly aligned with how reality actually is. And that's actually at the beginning of the Eightfold Path, because it's basically the map for how we steer the vehicle down the path. And wise intention is kind of a big part of that. Intention is where all of our kind of karmic habits get created, so we need to be really wise with our intentions. And then the second set in the Eightfold Path is speech, action, and livelihood, and those are our physical and speech actions in the world. The first is our mental, the second is our speech and our physical actions and how those affect. And we need to pay a lot of attention to that. This is the Buddha's path of liberation. So paying attention to speech isn't just to help your work go more smoothly, your relationships go more smoothly, your parenting go more smoothly, but it's really a part of helping yourself wake up and be liberated. And the same with the actions. We want to not cause harm, and we want to benefit. That's not just helpful to others. It also helps our path of spiritual deepening and our work, which obviously is a huge part of our life force we give to our work. We really want that aligned with our spirituality, so that it too, rather than being an obstacle to your awakening, is in service of it. And so the third part of the Eightfold Path is the meditation piece and wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. I've already talked about wise effort as applies to meditation, but we also want to apply wise effort to our life in general, our actions, our thoughts. And we want to, back up a little bit. Would you agree with this statement? If you're not mindful of your experience, there's no choice in your experience. That if you're not mindful, you're pretty much acting out your habits, your compulsions, your reactions. It's almost like we just mentally reflex, our mental reflexes. If we're not aware of what's going on internally, we have no choice in how we're acting. Do you agree with that? So, again, if we want to point ourselves down a path to more spiritual deepening, more happiness, we have to become conscious of how we act. And then we need to choose wisely how to act. How to act mentally, how to act with our speech, and how to act physically. And so, the essence of wise effort is to, we become conscious of ourselves through mindfulness, And then we want to choose out of the skillful set of mind states, actions, and speech. And we want to kind of let go of the unskillful side. And this skillfulness is what the Buddha defined as what conduces to more happiness for you. And unskillfulness is what conduces to more suffering. There's no judgment in it. It's really simple cause and effect. You act more skillfully, you'll become more happy. You act more unskillfully, you'll become less happy. And again, it's not judgmental. It's just kind of how it is. So the Buddhist ethical framework is basically, you know, morality without right and wrong. It's really morality with a clear seeing of what works to help yourself be happy. And because so much of our happiness is in our connection with others, it's what works to make others happy too. So it's very practical, very non-judgmental, and very real. And so in the Buddhist view, our happiness is just not something in a moment we could just wish up. If we could, none of you would be here. You wouldn't meditate. You could, if you could just willfully say, I wish to be happy, and boom, you're happy. You know, does anyone ever come to meditation because they're just so happy they realize they have to meditate? Right? We come to it because something is off and something's not working, and we need to learn something about ourselves so we can untangle the knot. So be great if we could just take the happy pill, you know, and bingo, all is solved. The Buddhist view is that's not possible. We can condition and determine our happiness, but we can only do it through conscious choice in the now. This, we can change our karma now. We can't change the past karma that we've already created. We can't change any future karma that, you know, we create when we're distracted. We can only change ourselves now. And your happiness, your well-being right now depends on your past actions, your past choices, and the past habitual patterns that you have and I have created. And it's not only our personal responsibility. Things happen to us. It's not all karma, but a lot of our happiness depends on karma. And there's, you know, things that happen, natural disasters, whatever, that are not karmically oriented. And let's not be mysterious about the word karma. Karma is basically mental habit, one thing. So what you practice in the past is what is more likely to occur out of your control right now. So if you've practiced a lot of generosity and kindness, mindfulness, that's going to be really easy for you right now. If you haven't practiced a lot, that's going to be harder. It's not you being bad or wrong or defective. It's actually just past, the past expressing itself lawfully in the present. So you can't do anything about what you've done in the past. But you, other than learn from it so that you can affect your future. Karma is bad news from the past side. It's really good news from the future side. We can change our future happiness by waking up to our experience right now and making a skillful choice. And that is a seed that we plant that will take fruit some way, somehow mysteriously, in our future. So the really bad news of waking up is that we are architects of our happiness. The really good news of waking up is that we are the architects of our happiness. This is a reality pill. It's not a happy pill. It's a reality pill of how to be happy. We have to be real. People ask, well, how much should we practice, you know, in meditation? And I kind of like to be a smartass and respond, it's not how much you're practicing. You're always practicing. Your everything we do is wiring our brain all day long. We are planting our karmic seeds of habit for the future all day long. We're always practicing. So the question isn't how much to practice. The question is, what do you want to practice? It's that simple. And wise effort is what we use to incline ourselves towards happiness by picking out of the skillful basket and abstaining from the unskillful basket. So, and the Buddha liked to make it really clear and really simple. So there's four wise efforts. Two of them relate to unskillfulness, and this has already been covered. But I don't think any of you were here. Were you here for that? Okay, so the first wise effort is to prevent unskillful states. And there's kind of ways to do that, so that the three kind of root suffering mind states, greed, aversion, and delusion, we can do things to prevent greed, aversion, and delusion from arising. And actually, one of the main things we can do is be mindful. You may notice this. Can you think of a time where you have you've had some unpleasant experience arise, and because you were mindful, you actually didn't get into a big aversive reaction? Some nod? Yes, no? Okay. Why didn't the aversion arise, even though it was unpleasant? Yeah, and that's, I would say, even pre that, that's definitely true. Even before that, something you were doing actually just prevented the aversion from arising. Because if you have a choice, you might actually have a little aversion arise, and then you might say, I don't have to go there. I'm going to go down this other road. But I'm talking about a time when it was unpleasant, and aversion just didn't arise at all.
I have a habit of sort of checking out. I mean, that goes way back.
Okay,
and
right.
And I think more recently it's sort of morphed with the mindfulness practice that I have learned, and I just don't engage.
Yeah. So the delusion is, remember, the three difficult roots of our suffering: greed, aversion, delusion. Checking out, you prevent the aversion, but you don't really, you're actually sort of like disconnecting from what's really happening. So you can't really gain wisdom that way. So delusion, it's good in that it can regulate our experience, but it doesn't transform it. But what mindfulness does is we have an unpleasant experience, and instead of aversion arising, it gets replaced with mindfulness. We're just curious, interested, and aware of our experience. So mindfulness is the opposite of suffering. It's the opposite of reacting. It's we replace all of that. We change our relationship with curiosity, interest, and awareness. So we prevent unskillful states by being mindful. We're always going to have pleasant, unpleasant, neutral stimulation. If we're mindful of that, we don't get into reaction with it. So the second wise effort is to abandon arisen, unskillful states. So that's a little more like what you're talking about. There's some aversion, and it's like, you know, I see the aversion, and I don't need to PhD it and pile it higher and deeper, right? I don't need a PhD in that aversion. I'm going to stay in the grade school and just let go. And basically change the channel, right? And the Buddha taught five different ways to abandon an unwholesome state or unskillful state that's there. And one of them is changing the channel. One of them is being mindful. One of them is contemplating kind of like the opposite theme. So if you're angry, go to metta. I'll just leave it that one there. The other one, oh God, I'm going to have a moment here. The antidote, so the opposite, change the channel, mindfulness. Oh, you contemplate just simply the fact that, oh, right, I'm going to create my future with practicing more aversion. So it's going to hurt now, but it's even going to hurt in the future too, because I'm basically a creature of habit. Yeah, I don't want to practice that habit. So it's kind of contemplating that it's really your habits that determine your happiness. So that's the fourth way. And the fifth way, when all else has failed, and this is just as a last resort, you grit your teeth, you clench your tongue against the roof of your mouth, and you crush your mind with your mind. Those are the Buddha's words. You actually just say, no, I am not doing that. And that, it sounds like aversion, but it's actually a kind of fierce compassion. It's like, I know the dangers of that. I've tried everything else. Nope, just firm no. The power of no.
I have a neuropsychology question kind of around this.
Yeah.
The feelings of in the body of pleasure and pain. I've gotten really curious about kind of what the difference is.
Nice.
Because it's all kind of in the same place, and it's all sensation.
Yeah.
And I'm not terribly good at naming my feelings, but it's sort of equally intense.
Yeah.
Equally present, and what I've finally kind of come to is it's really kind of about what kind of chemicals are coming around in the blood. You know, it's either stress chemicals or endorphins, pleasure chemicals. Uh-huh. And so when you're talking about that last resort example.
Yeah.
And you're in a state where, something is going on that is, making you and your body feel really uncomfortable and stressed, and it's kind of intrusive and hard to let go of. I'm asking is, can you put the strategies that you just put out
in order?
In that context, the context of a pretty intense physical sensation.
So the simplest thing, really, is I like to say mindfulness is a first resort. Mm-hmm. Try mindfulness first.
So mindfulness would be to recognize that this state is really an idea. It very well may go back to things way before. The situation at hand.
That would be kind of wise reflection on it, but it's not mindfulness.
Oh, so mindfulness is let go and go into something that's similar to what we consider practice?
Yeah. Mindfulness is just knowing what it's like. So this is the sacred question. What's it like? I mean, this sounds so ordinary, and this is being taught now as attention, as I've heard it called, attentional fitness. But it's not, that's great, but it's sacred. It's a sacred question. What's it like right now?
Uh-huh.
In that question, you're changing your relationship to your experience rather than having, by standing in front of a train and trying to stop a freight train, with a puny hand, you're going to step aside and you're going to let, like iron and smoke and ground shake, pass on through, and you get to be curious about that train, and aware. Mindfulness is knowing what's happening. So, and the let go that's part of mindfulness is we don't like dissolve the story completely, but we let go of being lost in it, identifying with it. We just realize, okay, those are the thoughts, this is the image, and this is what it's like in the body. So in the context of the five, you know, we sort of do the other things already. You know, we know how to change the channel. We all have our ways of changing the channel, right? We all have our ways of maybe thinking about, you know, the way anger might be harmful for us. And then we kind of do the other ones. But mindfulness is the one that we often don't know how to do. And the reason it's a really good, we tend to say that as a first resort, is because it not only deals with the situation at hand, but we actually transform our habit patterns by being mindful of them. The more we're mindful of aversion, the more we're actually dehabituating aversion. So mindfulness is a double win. It helps you deal with the present, but it also helps you decondition that habit pattern. So does that, am I answering your question?
Yes, very much so. I just got one other clarification. So it might not necessarily be practicing as we practice tonight, because that is really kind of letting go. But it might be just, and not necessarily holding on either, but just entering that feeling.
Exactly.
And detaching it from thoughts, if possible.
Yeah, and again, we often want to park our attention in the body for a lot of different reasons. But the main one is it's the least charge, usually, not always, but usually it has the least charge. Our thoughts like, oh my God, I got this 10 a.m. meeting with my boss and it's going to be uncomfortable, right? That's a tough thought. The sensation of like tingle in the belly or tight chest by itself is not very difficult, right? It's actually really the thoughts, which are just future bubbles, thought bubble worlds in the brain. That's the tough stuff. So so that's why we park in the body. We don't want to ignore the mental content, but we easily get swept away in it. So we want to kind of keep it in the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
Does that
Very
clarify?
Helpful. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So Peter, is what you're saying, if we really are mindful, we're neither going to the future or to the past with whatever just popped up.
Exactly.
We're just absolutely saying, I'm not going there and I'm not going there. Here it is.
Well,
I mean, that's what we want. It's hard.
Very hard. Because how often have we practiced this habit? You have to think about it. Yeah. So we have done in the mind gym, we've done hundreds of thousands of reps of past and future. And maybe a few hundred or thousand of this, right? So this is the thing. We don't want to be discouraged, because it's the first reps are always the hardest, you know. But what we're doing is deep and profound. It's what leads to liberation, freedom from suffering, and so we have to start now. We have to start with how we are. If we're new to meditation, we can't change that fact. If we've been practicing 20 years, we can't change that fact. Either way, we are what we got right now. And so, yes, we have to very much take refuge in the present. But we don't want to, again, we don't want to, out of aversion, just say, oh, that's a thought, that's bad, that's a memory, that's bad. We're going to do that. But if we can watch ourselves having past thoughts and future thoughts as a present moment experience, we can say to ourselves, when we're scared, what time frame are you in? When you're fearing something, what time are you in, past, present, or future?
If I'm mindful, I can say.
When you're
usually,
afraid.
Usually future.
Yes. So there's future thinking, but it's happening in the present.
But, so that's what I was, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so if I can say, I'm being mindful if I say, that thought just took me to the future.
Exactly. And you can, this is a very helpful mental note in anxiety or fear, future thinking, as well as when you're planning, it's also future thinking. It's a present moment experience, and miraculously, our minds can imagine the future. It's miraculous that we can do that. And then plan and actually say, yeah, I'm going to need 20 chairs for this party because I invited 30 people and probably only 2/3 will show up, so I'm going to need 20 chairs. And then it's kind of true, you know, when, you know, but it's still just a thought bubble happening in the present moment about the future. So we're not trying to get rid of the thoughts, but we want to wake up to them and realize past or future, and then come to the body. Is that clear? Okay, so those are the first two wise efforts, and we'll spend the rest of the evening on the next two to be discussed after the break. Stay tuned.
To be revealed.
You can probably guess what they are. The Buddha was very simple and very logical. They relate to skillful states. So we've prevented and abandoned unskillful states. So you can probably guess what we're going to do with skillful states. Two more to go. So we'll take a short break and yourself for being impatient. That's just aversion to aversion. And that's still aversion, right? So the immediate way to get skillful with an unskillful state is to be mindful. In an instant, you switch. And so this isn't about never getting angry, never getting impatient. This is about being kind to what you become aware of. It's like, oh, anger, okay. I'm angry. What's this like? And we can be kind to ourselves in that attention. So we're not, this is not to get into some kind of struggle or make unskillful states some kind of thing you're getting allergic to, you know. It's simply about, the essence of wise effort is to simply be mindful of the unskillful states when they arise. And when skillful states arise, it's to continue mindfulness and act. So we want to not act out the unskillful, but be mindful. And we want to act on our skillful states, but stay mindful. So it's really very simple how to do the four efforts. So Rumi has a very simple kind of poem about skillful and unskillful. It's called Tending Two Shops. He writes, "Don't run around this world looking for a hole to hide in. There are wild beasts in every cave. If you live with mice, the cat claws will find you. The only real rest comes when you're alone with God. Live in the nowhere that you came from, even though you have an address here. That's why you see things in two ways. Sometimes you look at a person and see a cynical snake. Sometimes someone else sees a joyful lover. And you're both right. Everyone is half and half, like the black and white ox. Joseph looked ugly to his brothers and most handsome to his father. You have the eyes that see from that nowhere, and eyes that judge distances, how high and how low. You own two shops, and you run back and forth. Try to close the one that's a fearful trap, getting always smaller. Checkmate. This way, checkmate that. Keep open the shop where you're not selling fish hooks anymore. you are the free-swimming fish. So we're always kind of running back and forth between these two ways of viewing things. Basically, you know, a spiritual, bigger perspective or a very narrow, aversive, critical perspective. And, you know, which shop do you want to tend? That's basically wise effort. You know, our attention, our energy goes where our attention draws it. So the more we cultivate and take our attention towards what's positive and what's skillful, the more it's going to happen. And I forget who said it, but to find out who someone really is, just figure out what they pay attention to. What we pay attention to is who we are. So, you know, we want to really incline the mind towards the skillful. And so the root of all our unskillful states and our suffering states is the illusion that we're separate. All of our difficulty comes from that illusion. Because we're separate, we get scared. Because we're separate, we get angry. Because we're separate, we get irritated, impatient. When we actually drop the separateness and have a sense of belonging, fear doesn't... It's just not really like... It doesn't make sense, fear, right? When we feel like we belong, when we're not separate. So here's kind of a good quote about that. Wei Wu Wei, have you heard of him?
Oh, the artist.
Philosopher. Okay. Maybe there's someone with a similar name who's an artist. This guy was a British man. I forget his name, but he went to China. He lived there a long time. And he kind of became a Taoist philosopher. He called himself Wei Wu Wei, which... Oh, I remember. What's the meaning of that? Oh, it's some kind of funny Taoist meaning, Wei Wu Wei, but... Anyway, so he had a lot of little pithy quotes, and he has a little book what's the name of his book? It might be The Crossroads, or it might be The Negative, Ask the Awakened, The Negative Way. I think it's The Crossroads. So anyway, here's his quote. Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and of everything you do is for yourself. And there isn't one.
And what?
And there isn't one.
Oh.
All of our unskillfulness comes from this mistaken belief that I'm separate and I'm over here and you're over there. And we all can feel this. I mean, we're built for this, right? We are built to connect. Our cells want it. Our cells, we get tight in our body in this separateness. We relax when we're connected. On a cellular level, not mental, just cellular, we relax. Mental too, but... So, essentially, all of our skillful states are states that either arise from connection or facilitate connection. So they're the obvious things: generosity, kindness, and awareness. These are the three root skillful states, the opposite of greed, aversion, and delusion. And we can say mindfulness/wisdom. So generosity is the opposite of greed, obviously. Kindness, the opposite of aversion. And wisdom or mindfulness, the opposite of delusion. So we want to cultivate those states that aren't here. So obviously meditation is part of the third wise effort. We're cultivating mindfulness, or we're cultivating metta. Being generous, we can cultivate our generosity. And this is one really cool practice that Joseph Goldstein, one of my teachers, likes to recommend for generosity. This is a really nice way to cultivate generosity. If you have a generous impulse, act on it. That's sometimes challenging. It isn't always easy. Sometimes we might feel generous towards a stranger, and we might feel like, whoa, that'll really, like, maybe they might think it's a little weird that some person's being nice. But it's an interesting practice. So we remember, we want to act on our skillful states. That deepens them. So when you have a generous impulse, it could be cool to take this up as a practice. When I notice the generous thought, I'm going to do it. Or you might have that thought and then be like, oh God, I don't want to give that away. You know, why did I think that? But then you can just ask yourself, what do I really want? Do I want to kind of like deepen my spiritual path? Or do I just want this little thing that I'm feeling so kind of attached to? I guess I do want to deepen the spiritual path. So, okay, give it away. So this is one way to really deepen your skillfulness. So because greed, you know, is really a difficult state, and you know, it's not to bash all desire. I mean, there's really skillful desire. There's very wholesome passion. You know, I mean, spiritual passion is a really, really wholesome state. Artistic passion, creative passion. I mean, these are. So this is not to bash all desire. Sexual desire, I mean, it can be very wholesome, very loving. Of course, it can also be completely objectifying and unwholesome. You know, so we need to like be aware and see what for us. When is desire/greed really getting in the way of you connecting, and when is it actually serving it? Obviously, desire and love are completely different things. You know, wanting something from somebody is kind of different from loving them. They can nicely come together sometimes, but they're not the same thing. So, to practice, to cultivate the opposite of greed is to practice non-greed. So, you know, it's to practice generosity. Another non-greed state is renunciation. It's related to that practice of, you know, giving what's generous, is that like we think we're going to get what we really want by having conditions be just right. And every now and then, hallelujah, the stars align, something comes together and conditions actually are exactly as we want them. And then what happens? You might remember a time, think of a time when, wow, something really went your way. You have one? And then what happened?
Things change.
Yes. So we never want to fight how great it is when conditions do come together. But if we want to like build our castle and park it there, you know, it's castles made in sand on the beach because the next wave is going to come in. And this is tough. But the Dharma is teaching, pointing to something where we can see that the happiness of being present is deeper than the happiness of getting what we want. And getting what you want is always topsy-turvy. You're going to get it sometimes, you're going to lose it. It's going to keep you spinning. It's the Maytag cycle. Just boom, boom. Got it, didn't get it. Got it, didn't get it. Got it, didn't get it. Right? It's why we're so restless. And mindfulness gives us this alternative of saying, wait a minute, I can just stop the struggle right now and wake up and just notice what it's like. And then as we orient this way more, we start to be satisfied by that, even when it's unpleasant, because we stop the Maytag, we stop the spin cycle. And even when it's unpleasant, we realize we can be content with unpleasantness. So renunciation is all about stopping the spin cycle. And it's about getting it. It's not about giving things up. It's about knowing that it's going to change. So sure, I can enter that vortex, that whirlpool, and I'm going to get what I want, and then I'm not, and then I am, and then I'm not. And I'm human, so I'll do that, but I'm going to really get it that there is an alternative. I can actually practice contentment with what is by being mindful. So renunciation, it's not a popular term in our like turbo stimulation world. I mean, we are going so the opposite, aren't we? With the internet, and I mean absolute instant, you know, complex gratification, and you know, infinitely, you know, and it's hard. It's hard to deal with the internet, I find. You know, it's addictive. There's just instant gratification, instant distraction, a moment of boredom. Oh, okay, you know, what's the weather doing now? You know, instead of looking out the window, going Yahoo.
You know, it's like 6 hours.
Yeah,
from now.
What's the stock market doing like in this hour? You know, or I don't know. Is there a new story in the Times? Is there, you know? But really, we know that we're happiest in the present moment. And so when we're renouncing all of the past and future, what we're really doing is giving ourselves a huge gift. You know, we know this. We need to remember this, you know, but we know it. In ourselves, we know it. When we're just not like stimulated by all this stuff, and it's simple, and there's a simple sunset, or just holding hands with your sweetie, or walking your dog, or petting your cat, we know, you know, how much that nourishes us. So that's really renunciation. It's just knowing that all the hyperstimulation is a kind of turbulence, and it's not. It can be gratifying, but it isn't peaceful. You know, they're not the same thing. Yeah.
Isn't there a way to skillfully navigate that as well?
Navigate the...
Yeah, I immediately thought when you said it's gratifying but not peaceful, I have my Feedly blog reader set up to access Tricycle and to access a couple of art websites that put up interesting things, and I actually find it really inspiring.
Great.
As a way to sort of...
Great.
I mean, I can totally get lost and
yes.
hit my email.
Yeah.
Email thing,
yeah.
You know, 100 times a day,
yeah.
too. But it seems like mindfulness can be brought to bear on those resources as well.
Great. Again, is it working for us or are we working for it, right? And it's really seeing when our computer use is actually, you know, beneficial to us. And when it's not, and it's hard sometimes.
Absolutely.
It's to know the line, you know.
Just a little bit of crack.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we can become Dharma junkies too. You know, the Dharma is not out there. Everyone wants, you know, the next retreat or the newest this, the newest that in Dharma. We always say the same thing. You've been coming for how many years?
Mm-hmm.
You're just hearing me say same thing. It's not ever different. You know, we're just saying the same thing. But it's not. But we want the Dharma. The Dharma can be sort of some new teaching. I'll try Ajahn Shanti for a while. You know, or I hear there's this new great freedom group. You know, the non-dual. I'm going to try that. Or you know, Shinsen Young. You know, he's got a really really methodical approach, and I'm kind of a scientist, so I want that one. Or you know, this and that. We can do this even with spiritual stuff. So, and you're using the internet there in a way that you're seeing the way you described it, that you know that's really helpful for you. So, you know, we just have to learn. I think I'm going to tell just one generosity story because it was really moving to me. Guy Armstrong, one of the teachers on this last retreat, told this story. His good friend Carol Wilson is longtime Dharma buddies, Dharma teachers, and you know, they've been practicing 40 years. They've been teaching together. I mean, they're not partnered. They're with other people, but they're just really dear friends. And Carol goes to Thailand or Burma, I think Burma every year. And the generosity there in a Buddhist Theravada culture is just profound. Those cultures, I mean, generosity is the first teaching of the Buddha for anybody, you know. And this whole tradition is here because of generosity. When I was an Anagarika, which is sort of a novice monk, in Thailand, I was fed every day. I practiced for 3 months for free in a monastery in rural Thailand in a rice farming community. And I was fed every day. And there was people in that monastery, the same people, 20 to 30 people every day, the entire time I was there. And they were so sweet and generous. It was amazing. And it made, you know, being in robes, it's like, wow, I've got to live up to these robes because the people are being so generous and supportive of me. The monastery, there was two big meditation halls. All the monks had little kutis, little meditation huts for themselves where we would sleep. And I practiced for free for 3 months as a Westerner. And these people probably in a year, you know, make less than one of us would in a few weeks. And yet they were giving us food. So in Burma, Carol went, there was a typhoon there recently. I'm not sure what year this was, but it really hit the coast of Burma really bad. And Carol always brought money to help out with monasteries and that she would raise in the U.S. to help, because Burma is a very poor country and the military junta really has really wrecked the economy there. And she was in a monastery somewhere inland where it wasn't hit by the typhoon as bad, but she heard that where the help was really needed was in coastal Burma, very rural, very poor. And so she bought a truckload or several of rice, and with some people drove it down there, and from one of the monastery in a small town distributed out, and it was rationed, and every family got a certain amount of rice, and people brought plastic bags and filled up their plastic bag, and people were starving, and they and some people were so poor they didn't even have plastic bags, so they put their allotment of rice in their dress and carry it home. And the monks were not getting much food at all because the lay people didn't have any food. So the next morning, Carol heard back later, after she left. But the next morning, the monks went out for alms. And all the people are lined up giving away their rice to the monks. And these are people who had been starving. And they are there, taking care of their monks, and their nuns. And so this is the spirit of generosity that the tradition of Buddhism has been carried in. It's such a skillful state. We all know this. It is so connecting and happy making, and it's good for your spiritual path to be generous. And we know this, but it's really at the core, the crux of the Buddhist spiritual path, you know. So be generous. It'll really help your mind. Being greedy it kind of works in the moment, but it's tight, and you get what you want, but you know, it's not expensive, you know. So cultivating non-greed through renunciation, cultivating generosity through giving. We can cultivate non-aversion, right? That's the other, you know, root difficult state. And remember, aversion is all these things like fear, jealousy, irritation, boredom, restlessness. Those are kinds of aversion. It's a lot of things. So in the Theravada framework, non-aversion is considered wholesome or skillful. So not just the opposite, which is kindness, but anything that's non-aversion. So one thing that really brings up a lot of aversion is comparing. We compare ourselves all the time. If you think about it, how smart are you? Your answer to that question is a comparison. How good an athlete are you? How kind are you? How tall are you? How generous are you? These are all comparisons. Now, if you said, I'm 6'3", that's not a comparison, right? That's an intrinsic statement. But if you said, I'm tall, instead of 6'3", that's a comparison. You're just comparing yourself to the norm. Our comparisons are never true. It's only about who we're holding in our comparative mind. A friend and I were playing tennis. We thought we were doing pretty well. And then two college kids showed up on the next court, and we were just like, oh my God. We suck. You know, like, did anything change about our playing? Nope. We were in comparing mind, you know? I don't know, if two kids who had never played tennis showed up, we might have been feeling really good about how our tennis was. But this is the thing, our comparisons are never intrinsic. It's always in relation to someone else. And who knows, I mean, Barack Obama, maybe he compares himself to Martin Luther King or some other president or something, you know. The comparing never stops. The only way it stops is we realize, oh, it's just like completely arbitrary. And we usually have a negativity bias, and we compare ourselves to come up short. So instead of comparing ourselves to make ourselves feel better, we usually do it to make ourselves feel worse. But either way, it's wrong. It's not intrinsic. It's not who you are. Who you are is 6'3" or 5'4". That's who you are. Who you are is as generous as you are in this moment. That's who you are. So comparing brings up a ton of aversion. So this might be just a recommendation as a good way to cultivate non-aversion. Is to actually, you can't just say, I won't compare, and usually have that wish come true. But you can say, I'm going to really wake up to comparing mind, and I'm going to notice when I do it. And when I do it, I can just say, comparing, because I know it's basically completely artificial. Am I making sense? Anyone agree, disagree, neutral? Agree? This is the thing, it's in the Buddhist map, it's one of the last things to go before full enlightenment. Even after greed and aversion are gone, the comparing habit is still there. We're social creatures. We just compare. It's deeply rooted in us. So don't struggle and say, I will never compare again. And that begins now. Oh, God. I'm already worse than Jack Kornfield. Comparing. It lasted 4 seconds. You can't resolve that. But you can resolve to wake up to it. And it's actually really liberating to just say, oh, comparing. That's the whole thing. Kind of like, you know, you saying, I just don't have to go down that road. I'm just not going to go there. That's just me comparing myself. And I'm going to come up short compared to that guy, and I'm going to come up tall compared to that guy. It's not me. It's not me. Okay. The last thing to cultivate is non-delusion or wisdom. Right? So of the three, generosity, kindness, mindfulness, slash wisdom. So that's a no-brainer. You know what to do there. Cultivate mindfulness. It's hard to cultivate wisdom, but if you practice mindfulness, it makes you wise. Aging makes us wise because we learn from the hard knocks of life. Mindfulness will knock you harder, and you'll learn a lot faster and get wiser faster. We all get wiser as we age, but you know, why not get wise while you're still young? Practice mindfulness. It's a wisdom practice. The more you practice, the wiser you get. All right. Anyone want to add a comment at this point?
This is a question. When I hear you say, or anyone say, stop comparing, something along those lines.
Remember, I didn't say that.
Well, okay, so cultivate awareness of comparing.
Yes.
And with the implication being that we sort of drop that.
You don't drop the arising. You drop the feeding of it once it arises. And if you can just say, oh, comparing, it can disappear in a moment. It can. So
can you address I'll just clutter it in. We live in a world where we're just at work, say. How do you know when you're doing a good job? Is there a quick sort of, here's how you know. If you're not comparing yourself to others and your status, how do you know that you're successful? How do you know that you're accomplishing something?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's a little complicated in a work situation because your livelihood, continued livelihood, might depend on an evaluation that does compare you to others. It's built in often to workplace situations. So that's like, okay, I just have to play this game. But it's not. It's a game I'm playing. Right? So we can become conscious of it. So, but then a second piece of that is, how do I measure my success? There's how you're being measured by your work environment. It's different from how you measure your success. And you've got to play the game, so to speak, to an extent. But it's a really cool question to take up. Okay, well, that's what I'm getting rewarded for in this workplace. But what is intrinsically my reward? When do I feel good? And, you know, how do I measure my own success? You can't hear that enough?
Right, that there's an alternative that's rooted in me.
Exactly. And it's rooted in your body. It's like, how do I feel in my body, you know? In the various parts of my work. And usually when your body is relaxed and not tense, or you're open, your heart is open, or your mind is bright, that's a sign of intrinsic success. That's intrinsic reward. You just like doing your job. You like the mastery of it. You like the service of it. You like, you know, the learning. You know, whatever those things are, you know, that's what jazzes you. And we can really make that a different thing from how we're being measured. And if the two don't fit together at all, then that's a problem. But and it's not what we think. When we actually say what really, we can have our own views and ideals about how we should be. And but to actually feel our heart and our body about how we are, that's the best way of knowing our success. The thing that's working for us emotionally and physically is going to be what sustains us. And we can have ideas about how we think we should be, and that data can conflict sometimes. What we're getting inside we might actually be getting fed by something that we didn't realize. It somehow doesn't fit our ideal about how we think we should be. So it can be surprising to really take mindfulness to that question. Okay. We didn't do the fourth, but actually Jean Leonard did last week. The fourth is prolonging a skillful state that's here. And there's lots of ways to do this. One is to really notice it. Look for the positive. Look for, you know, when you feel connected. Look for when you feel generous. Look for when you feel content. We miss it a lot of the times. So to prolong an arisen state, we have to know it's even arisen. So, and because of the negativity bias of the brain, we will look for what's wrong a lot. We need to be on the radar for what's going well. And one way to prolong it is you notice it and then share it. Share your blessings with people, with your sweetie. It's a great way to go to sleep with your partner. You know, share your blessings. Might be a tiny bit satisfying, right? It's got a little bit of like digital finger joy, but yeah, it, you know, I think the face-to-face is going to be a little more gratifying. Find a gratitude buddy, you know, find someone to share it with. It's contagious, you know. The more you and a friend or sweetie orient to the positive, you know, the more you'll see it, and it's contagious. You know, my sweetie and I sometimes will go on a hike and we'll say, okay, for the next hour we can only talk about what's in the present, or we can only talk about what's good, you know. And, you know, those are ways, those are just simple ways of noticing. And then you prolong it just sort of by sharing it with each other. But we're sort of at time, and I'll just stop here.